This podcast is part of the Everyday Heroes Podcast Network, the network for first responders and those who support them.
Hey guys, welcome to the Hero Academy podcast, the place where you can celebrate and highlight our frontline heroes. People such as nurses, firemen, EMS, police officers, and military are all heroes without capes. I don't care about politics, only positivity and purpose. I only care about those that have chosen to serve our society. I believe in collaboration over competition. Here, you'll learn the secrets and strategies that let ordinary people become extraordinary inside of their purpose. Sometimes we'll throw in some simple side hustles that everyday regular people are doing, things that you could do to make some extra money, especially if you're starting to think about retirement and what's next. Inside this podcast, each week you'll learn from people like you that were working full time but still found the time to create a course, grow a big team, create a coaching program, a large audience, or a profitable side hustle. The steps they took, their backstories, and how they overcame their burnout that they were facing. The perfect blend of mindset and techniques. Carpe diem. Now let's get your dream lit for your freedom. I'm your host and coach, Super Dave. Let's go. Hey guys, welcome to this week's episode of the Hero Academy. I have a former Navy man, and I don't want to say anymore. You're also an author, right?
Yeah.
So I'll just let you tell your story. You can introduce yourself to the audience because it's a pretty incredible story.
Well, thanks, man. Yeah. So my name is J.L. Hancock. Go by Jim. I was in the Navy for 20 years. I spent the bulk of that as a cryptologist. And then I ended up probably about 12 of that was with the special operations community, where I did about over 100 combat operations with different parts of the special operations community. I screened and got into a really small a program where there was about probably about 100 of us total in the entire Navy that did this job, but we had to basically embed within different special operations units and conduct combat operations with them overseas. But the bulk of my career as a cryptologist was working with in the intelligence communities. And so that work was, that work itself was pretty sensitive. But what was cool is I got to go from sitting at a desk with headphones like the ones I'm wearing right now to running around a field with guns, carrying some of the most advanced technology out there. And then that ultimately led me to being selected to run this program. Originally, it was called the N39X, X standing for experimental. And we would chase emerging tech within the RF radio frequency space and computers and things like that. And then eventually that turned into standing up an office called the N9, or Future Concepts and Innovation Directorate. And I became the senior enlisted advisor of that organization. And I ended up running a portfolio of about 40 different program projects. And some of which eventually led to things like the first artificially intelligent drone put in combat.
Man, I have so many questions. All right. So my first question is, are you retired from active duty? Like, what's your status with the military?
Yeah, I'm retired now. I'm no longer in the military.
And
I did 20 and punched out. Yeah.
I know you've been on a few other shows. Has anyone from the military ever reached out and said, hey, be careful about talking about this particular subject after you've been on shows? I guess you're probably pretty smart about it.
Yeah, I actually, I used to work, the office I was at was located next to the individuals that screen the publications that are put out for people that had been in the special operations community. And so I actually, in certain cases, that individual would walk up and be like, hey man, can you check out this part and tell me whether or not this jives, or what do you think is wrong with this, or what's right with this? Let me know if there's anything, any issues. And so because of the fact that I had to understand classification at that level, I don't really worry about it. And most of the time, you'd be surprised, people don't really care. unless you get a lot of attention and you specifically are outing something.
Okay.
But in general, no, you don't really have that problem.
Do you know Atlas Altman? He's the author of The Rule of Three. He's a buddy of mine.
No, I don't. Sorry.
I'm going to link. That's okay. I'm going to link you guys up.
Cool.
I'm not sure if he has a show or not, but it's just, it would be a really good connection for both of you.
Sounds good.
You're in the special ops world. So I know you still kind of work in and around that world, right? Like privately?
Yeah. So I worked for a couple defense contractors and I consulted for a while, but now I work doing contracts for still under certain parts of the DoD in the innovation area. So I do a lot of, I think I could probably fall more in the category of a futurist. So I help identify and develop concepts for future operations. And based upon the knowledge I had of different emerging technology, I lived a lot in the VC space in my last job, chasing down emerging technology and finding disruptive capabilities for the warfighter. And because of that, I still have a pretty good reputation within that group. And so people call me up and they're like, hey, I need help with this particular concept. A lot of systems engineering approaches to problems, holistic understanding of problems, because people tend to be extremely siloed.
Are you rich?
No.
No. But you could, now that you're a private citizen, you could become a venture capitalist for a project if you wanted to, right?
There's work that I could do in that space. Right now, I did end up working with, when I was working for one defense contractor, I just took a particular job because I needed it at the time, but also it gave me, I'm really big on access and placement. So understanding things from the bottom up, and I wanted to just get some general understanding of what it was like inside of a large defense contracting organization. And then I eventually found that somebody told me a while back, you know, when you get out of the military or whatever, you have to prioritize three things, one of three ways. Either you're going to prioritize the mission, your time, or your money, right? But all of those things can't be prioritized at the top. You can't have lots of money, a lot of time, and have a really awesome mission all at the same time. Which one's more important to you? And right now, I'm kind of prioritizing my time and the mission a little bit over the finances. But I'm able to do a lot more in very little time. And spend a lot more time with my family, considering how much time I spent away from them. And that's more important to me.
You'll see me writing from time to time, because that's a good quotable, the mission, the money, or the time. So I wrote that down because I'm going to use that. I'm definitely stealing that. And I consider myself a futurist, too. Like, when I was a kid, I used to watch Beyond 2000 all the time. And yep. Now I can't never pronounce his name. The Asian guy, Mikio. I watch
Michio Kaku.
Yeah, that guy. I still can't say it even after you say it. I watch everything that he puts out. I love Elon Musk. I love AI. I'm at an age where like I would get injected with nanobots to improve my health and improve my knees. If they had, I know some people are so anti. Cyborg.
Yeah.
Are you anti-cyborg? Like, would you get an implant if you could be connected to the net all the time? Or
oh, the net. So that's an interesting question, because there are non-invasive means of creating a human machine interface. And so it depends upon what the value is of having that built into you, right? So like the difference between like Neuralink and doing something like optogenetics, those are two different ways of solving a similar problem.
Okay.
One is non-invasive and the other is invasive. So I'm not super excited about putting 2000 electrodes on my shunted into my brain.
Okay.
I'm just not super keen on that idea. However, and I write about this in my book because I kind of stumbled upon it when I was at a symposium at Caltech. But optogenetics is they inject protein into your brain, and they can create. I'm simplifying it because I don't want to go into optogenetic opsins and all these different things that nobody cares about. Basically, though, you can take a protein that's derived from algae, and they inject it into your brain, into the lipids in your brain, the fat cells in your brain. And if you excite it with the right frequency of light, you can change synaptic activity in the brain.
Wow.
And so they use it for treating people with Parkinson's. That's what they're doing the studies on. But they can restore light, the vision. They can do a lot of different things with optogenetics. And but the cool thing is it's literally just they put light on the outside of your head. They don't have to physically put something in there other than the proteins. But the proteins are there's plenty of proteins in your body that have not that won't adversely affect you.
What's the title of your book?
My book's called The Hawk Enigma.
And what's it about?
It's about, so imagine Q from James Bond, except for he goes out on operations with the forces, but he's struggling with a lot of post-traumatic stress, but because he's not an actual like shooter, as we call them in the military, like an actual like SEAL or whatever, he kind of hides the fact that he has these issues. And so him burying his post-traumatic stress, he thinks that if he just works through it, it'll go away. But he doesn't self-medicate and he doesn't deal with it the way that outwardly people think that he would deal with it. So he buries himself in his work and everybody thinks, well, that guy's good. He's solid. He's always there, reliable, but he's at a breaking point on every day. And nobody realized that until one day he starts hearing voices in his dreams, warning him about the future. And he starts thinking he's losing his mind. And then at the same time across the ocean in Japan, two scientists have gone missing that were developing something called the God algorithm. And so he gets called in with this task force to figure out where the scientists went. They were American citizens living abroad. And then they're going to discover that this task force and this AI algorithm are all tied back in with his dreams.
I don't read a lot of nonfiction, but that book sounds dope.
You mean fiction? You mean? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, fiction. Yeah. I mostly read nonfiction. Yeah. I don't read a lot of nonfiction. Yeah. I said it reverse.
Yeah, nonfiction. That's two negatives makes positive, so you're good.
That sounds pretty cool. Any movie offers? Anybody talking about turning that into a movie yet?
No, I'm indie published, so I'm still working on my street cred, you know, so not quite there yet. I'm working on a sequel. Should be done this summer. Should be out this summer.
That's awesome, man. Yeah. So one thing that I think you could do is you could turn it into an animation, like a short 30-minute film. And that is what you could shop to screen.
Making it a graphic novel as well. You know, it's very much designed like a movie. The chapters are short. It moves really fast. I really like stories where you have multiple storylines and you don't know how they interweave. And then you're following these storylines. You're like, what the heck does this have to do with the other thing? And all of a sudden it just like hits you like a truck. And you're like, holy crud, is right in front of you the entire time. I love it when books do that and stories do that. So I wanted to write one that did that. I feel like I pulled it off.
Is that your first book or you have any others?
That was my first one. The sequel's coming out. And then I've got some other. I'm probably going to come out with maybe two next year. I've got a good idea for another short novella that I'm going to write. It's a little bit more futuristic.
So just to go back to the SEALs, because I kind of glossed over that. Were you considered a Navy SEAL or are you just embedded with them?
No, absolutely not. So on two sides, it was a choice. I could have gone to BUDS. And this isn't a knock on the SEAL community in any way at all. I mean, absolute respect for everything they do. I just didn't want to be one. There was like, do I continue this? I have this knowledge of cryptology, which is the exploitation of radio waves. So to understand cryptology is you have an IT person who helps comms work, right? So they're your radio operators. You have electronic warfare operators that use radio waves to jam GPS, to block people from communicating. And then there were cryptologists. I like to sit right in the middle and just listen. That's all I do.
Okay.
I'm the person that's quietly just watching, letting you do your thing. But I can tell where you are, what's going on. I'm gathering and collecting the entire time until it's time for me to do my thing, right? And so I was like, well, how many people actually do that job embedded with the special operations community? It was like, there's just 100 of them. Wow. However, at the time, there wasn't a single mission that went on in which one of us wasn't on the op. And so when I got downrange, I remember I was getting fought over by different units because they couldn't go out the door unless I was with them.
Right.
And there were so few of us that it was like a source of contention for different reasons. Some were like, why don't they train us to do it? But when they did that, they had a 10% success rate. they went way down in their ability to actually conduct the missions effectively. So they're like, let's just keep the subject matter expertise there, keep using these people. But like when I was in Iraq, I'd go out one night with SEAL Team 7, and then I'd come home, and then I'd go right out the next night with the Green Berets, because they didn't have somebody like me in that part of the country. And it was awesome, because I would walk to a different part of the compound, and they're like, all right, we're hitting this. And it was just a completely different world between those two different units. Those organizations do not operate anywhere close to the same. And so it was fun, but it was a little cool, but it was a little scary at the same time, because you like jump into this other unit and you're like, wait, you guys don't do anything near the same. How do you do this?
Right.
Green Berets were very much flying by the seat of their pants. It was fun, but it was a little hair raising sometimes.
Regimented. I told you when I was in Costa Rica, I met a Army Ranger who was a high ranking. I don't know the rank that he held, but I don't want to misquote it, but I know that he was in command of special forces, and he had this walk about him. We started talking about Muay Thai and him training jiu-jitsu and him training, like, he just looked like a tough guy. Mm-hmm. And that's what we started talking about. And then I was like, hey, I have a podcast. I'd love to have you come on it. And he's like, what's the name of it? I said, The Hero Academy. He's like, oh, no. He's like, I don't do that hero stuff. And I'm like, no, that's just the name of the show, bro. I'm like, I promise. I won't make you feel uncomfortable. I'm like, it's just about you. It's not, and I won't label you. I promise I won't label you. But I respect the work that you do. Like, you've done some really cool things. Like I said, I am a futurist, and I love everything about tech. And I know that you were on the front lines of some of the most advanced tech in the world. Do we have robots that are walking around as soldiers right now?
No,
we don't.
No. No. So I would say the most advanced technology we had was made by, so no, walking around. No. And that's because,
like that dog that they always show at MIT.
Yeah. So, all right. So you can talk about robot dogs, but robots have this thing called the Moravec's paradox. And the Moravec's paradox basically is that you can use something like, I don't know, large language models and whatever to create these very advanced AI forms, because you have this, you have this massive amount of data that you can use to create and build models. However, that paradox basically is like, yeah, at the same time, in order to make a robot conduct the most basic of human physical functions requires an insane amount of computation and a large amount of different types of actuators and servos and things like that.
We need quantum computers. That's what we really need.
No, not at all.
No?
No, totally no. Not to shut you off like that, but quantum computing has nothing to do with that.
Well, you said a large amount of input.
A lot of processing capacity, but quantum is not the way to solve that problem.
Okay.
So
what is? What is?
Well, it comes down to complexity. Okay. So you have all these different elements of input to create the same response that we have. Think about it this way. Your body, all the way down to the cellular level, is a bunch of what scientists refer to as an abstraction layer, a bunch of different contingencies stacked on top of each other. If this happens, then this, and if this happens, then that. And our bodies created the stability that we live under over millions of years of evolution, right? And so then you're trying to take that and replicate it in a matter of years using a completely different medium, like metal, to deliver the same effect. And so it's like you're ignoring all of the computation and processing that takes place all the way down to the bottom of our DNA.
Do you believe that there was a intelligent designer that created that whole system that is us?
You said it's
so complex, right? There's so many layers, so many contingencies, so many things working in background down to the DNA. So to me, that tells me that somebody programmed it that way.
depends upon how you want to look at it. So part of it, I would say, one part of me would say, it's absolutely possible it could have been programmed. The other part of me says that's how nature works. That's how evolution works. Is a mutation, a happy mutation takes place, and it creates a positive outcome, and you're able to reproduce it. And over time, that reproduction just starts changing the physiology of this structure. But if we're going back to robots, it really comes down to what is the most efficient type of robot. And as a police, as a somebody who worked in law enforcement or whatever, you'd appreciate this. I was a big proponent of these drones that we were messing with, because when we started working with them, we quickly realized, you know, the last thing we want is somebody putting their gun down and picking up the controllers for a drone and flying the drone, because now they're exposed, right? Yep. So we're like, how can we create drones that make their own decisions? And so in 2016, we started working with this company called Shield AI. Shield is now worth about $3 or $4 billion. But at the time, there were like 6 people. And they were building this drone that could fly inside of houses and make decisions on its own, right? Now, 2018 was the first time we actually put that drone in combat. The drone flipped to the front of a building and entered the building by itself. It made its own decisions when it went inside the building. And the thing that was most exciting about that, some people would look at it and say, it's a flying Roomba. I could knock it down with a broomstick. And we were like, that's not the point. You're missing the point of what that robot offers you. What is the risk? What is the biggest risk when you go inside of a building? Is that you don't know.
The unknown.
Unknown risk, right?
Yep.
So now I've got a camera that's going to go in there and identify where things are. And the example I always give when people are like, well, okay, so great, the camera can go in there. What does that offer you? And I was like, well, it offers you the ability to mitigate risk by creating offset. There's no reason for me to be physically closer inside the building if I can send the drone inside. And another example I've used is another podcast. But I think this highlights the problem in the best way. Okay. So looking at the scenario that happened with Breonna Taylor. Okay. You had 2 stupid policies that were in direct conflict with each other. A no-knock policy with a stand-your-ground policy, where you can be at home with a gun and defend yourself if somebody kicks your door down. At the same time, cops can kick your door down at any time. So at one point in time, they're not going to kill each other. This is a horrible – whoever allowed that to happen is an idiot, right? So that's a known. That's a given. There's the other social implications of race and all that, but that's a separate discussion that I don't want to get into. Not because I don't think it's important, but just because this is irrelevant to the technology conversation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, because for me, I'm looking at it from a tactics, techniques, and procedure perspective as a TTP thing. If I'm going to go into a building, I want to know what's in there. I don't want to just kick the door down unknowing, especially if I don't have control. And one of the things that started happening downrange when we were conducting more operations is we started shifting away from things like dynamic entry, where you just kick down a door and go flooding into the building. And it started becoming more and more deliberate. I'm not going to name the specific tactics because those are sensitive. However, there was one thing that ended up happening was called a call out, where you just surround the building and then you just get on a megaphone and you say, come out of the building, right? And what we discovered is the only types of people that stayed in the building were either infirmed and unable to get out, or they were hostile. But we don't want to go in with the same level of hostility with both those scenarios, right? Because if it's an old man in a bed, I don't need to come in guns blazing, right? And so the same thing with that Breonna Taylor scenario. If they'd have just gone in, knocked on the door, called out who they were, and if they got no response, the door goes down, but they step away and the drone goes in. Now the drone gets attacked. Who cares?
Right.
I don't care if you attack my drone. I now know what level of aggression you're at. I know you're hostile, right? Or you're just upset. Either way, there's no reason for me to shoot you, right? Like, I could be away from the building and call you out, and I can keep the scenario safe. The reason why we were aggressive in places like Iraq and Afghanistan is because we didn't know who was coming to set up on us. You are always worried about the risk of someone coming from behind because they heard you. Are you worried about that in the States? Now, I grew up in Albuquerque. There are places in Albuquerque where that is a legit concern. And we call it the war zone, right? But there are but in most cities, that's not the case. If the cops, police officers surround an area, set a perimeter, you own that space now.
Right.
It's yours.
Right.
You can calm everything down, but you still need to know what's going on. You need intelligence on the inside. That's where the drones gave us a benefit. Send the drone in. I get initial. Here's the thing that was cool about him. It wasn't just the camera. I was getting a real-time map of the building as it was being created. I had you could create a three-dimensional image out of that. I could do it on multiple floors, and it would, if it identified a person, it gave you their position in the building on the map on your phone. So just doing all that in real time.
My sergeant came from the identification section, and they used that during homicides to on a tripod. I forget the name of the machine, but they put it on a tripod, and it maps the room.
Was it a Matterport?
Something like that.
It's about like a foot wide, black, like a black cubic thing that's puts on a tripod. So those are used in real estate. It's made by a company called Matterport.
Yeah.
You can do it with your phone. It's the same exact same thing. It's just it's more stable.
Yeah. But so imagine, so I can only imagine having a drone that can fly around a room and do that in real time.
Yeah, that's what we were building.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So
it was more rudimentary back earlier stages of it, but the very first one it put out, it could do just LiDAR, so it would just give you a rudimentary map of the landscape in there. But the value it gave to the warfighter was dramatic, because now in one case they sent an assault force towards one group of buildings, but the compound was too big to, and they didn't have enough people to securely cover another building, so they just sent the drone. And they're like, well, let the drone figure it out, and then we'll determine whether or not we need to commit any forces to that area of the building. And in one instance, they immediately identified the house had a house-borne IED. It was rigged with explosives in the front of the door. They're like, well, good thing I didn't send any people over there, right?
I know that distance and time is the best thing that gives you the most amount of safety. So, like, you could send – they could be, like, a block away, or, I don't know how close they want to be tactically, but they could be – a little bit ways out, and you can be a little bit closer, or you don't even have to be close. You could just be back at the base controlling the drone, right?
Yeah, depending upon what the op is, right? And the range of the capability system. Most of the time, you still need somebody there physically, right? But yeah. We were building some systems where you have like a small fixed-wing drone that had operating like we call it marsupial operations, but it's like you have one drone carrying other drones, and we were dropping smaller drones that could clear buildings by themselves.
That's cool.
And so these are, and keep in mind, these are non-kinetic at the time. They were just ISR assets. They were things that just fly in and just get video and just let you know what was going on. But the psychological effect of a drone coming in that can see you, track you, and chase you. And then what was really cool is we're working with another company that had, they had basically built up their software and their drone to operate kind of like a big selfie stick. And so it would fly around and get any position you wanted. But one of my favorite modes that they had was called lead mode, where it would stay in front of you. And I was like, hey, can you do a patrol feature with this thing where it just holds one side of the building? And they're like, yeah. And I was like, okay. They're like, and then it'll follow people. It's like, no. You want to go into lead mode. And they're like, why? We want to see where the person goes. And I was like, what is the psychological effect of a drone that gets in front of you? You turn around and try to run the other way. Now it's going to create this corralling effect on the person, because no matter what they do, the drone zips in front of them. So then their imagination starts thinking this drone can do a lot more than it really can. And then they just stop. And then you roll them up. And so
I was, the whole time that you were talking about that, I was thinking, how can they eventually use that for police officers in the field? And
that company is Skydio, and they're using it for law enforcement now. That's their entire purpose.
How do you spell that company?
Skydio. Skydio. They're the probably the biggest drone manufacturer in the United States now. Their X10 that comes out next year has all those features I just mentioned. They also can integrate on a 5G, and you can control that drone from anywhere in the country. That's in the world, actually.
That's really cool, because I remember I told you I was an active street cop, and I remember chasing a guy who dove into a house through a window, and then I dove in after him. There were other cops coming and getting close, but I dove in. I'm a smaller guy. I dove in. And then once I was inside that house, I was like, boy, that was really stupid of me. I was like, I went straight to the front door and unlocked the front door. And then, all the troops came rushing in. But but I think that guy went into a basement. I didn't search the house by myself, but I remember a few scenarios where I just had an angel on my shoulder and got lucky that, you know, most of the guys that we're chasing in the street just want to get away from you. They're not actually trying to hurt you.
Yeah. And that other thing I was talking about, the drones, it led to something. It was actually a Chula Vista police officer. I think he was the captain of the head of the police. He works for Skydio now. He's retired, but he coined the phrase drone as a first responder. And when I was first started talking to that company, this is back in 2017 or 18. I think I was one of their first government contracts. But I was like, look, imagine this. Imagine a police officer pulls up to a stop and you have a drone that can communicate two different ways. And then you send the drone. It just flies up and it goes right into the front windshield. It's looking straight at the driver. The driver, all they have to do is hold up their paperwork right up under the window and they can scan it right there. The officer doesn't even need to get out of the vehicle. They can monitor from whatever they're seeing from there. If they feel they need to get out, we refer to this as graceful degradation. You can always degrade back to the simplest way of solving the problem, but you use the most technological one on the edge to mitigate risk. So if there's a high risk aspect of what's going on, the drone is what's getting in between you and there. And so the officer is completely safe. And here's the other part that's beneficial to that. The civilian doesn't need to feel like they're at risk either, because the drone can't do anything to them other than just be a means of interacting with somebody. It becomes an intercom at that point in time.
Yeah. Yeah. And no, so I feel like, yeah, I've seen you on another podcast talking about that.
Maybe.
did you ever talk about that type of a drone scenario before?
I have, but I've been talking about it for years with my customers. I'm sure it's that kind of same topic has proliferated. I've always been a big proponent of drones as a means of mitigating risk
and de-escalating the total de-escalation situation too. Yeah.
So I can't remember the sociologist that did the study, but in 2020 they had this guy. You know, when they're all going around, everybody's trying to solve all the social justice problems, right? And he was going around all these police forces and he was trying to, they were doing the whole, like, let me explain to you these problems with race and how you shouldn't have these prejudice and whatever, and blah, blah, blah. But he said, you know,
which after, by the way, all of those problems have magically gone away.
Yeah, they're all gone.
They're all gone. But, like, what happened?
But what he discovered is that when they instead of trying to save their souls, he's found that when they changed their TTPs and they had the officers slow down, take a beat, count to 10 as they in the situations where they had to draw their weapon, they had it was like a 40 to 50% decrease in the amount of shootings they had. And it was more about people taking a beat and de-escalating, right? Because they didn't need to go that high. And there are certain cases in which, you know, it happens anyway. But there
are you on Instagram?
Yeah.
Did you see the guy was on parole? He chokes the cop on the car stop. Did you see that video?
I haven't seen that one.
Well, basically, the cop comes out. He comes out of the car. He's real hot. He comes out hot. Like, I think he just stopped him for speeding, or he chased him a little bit, and he tells him, get out of the car. And the cop is already hot. He's hot.
Yeah.
And he tells the guy, all right, now the guy's not giving his ID or something like that. He's like, all right, now turn around, put your hands behind your back. And the guy just, like, he's much bigger than the cop. He just starts choking him and the cop ends up shooting him. And the family had a problem with it. And I have to find because someone, like, slowed it down and he's like, look, this is where he's choking the officer. And then a lot of comments say, well, he didn't have to come out so hot. I definitely want to share that one with you, because that's a perfect example of where the drone could have maybe, like, you know, slowed the situation down a little bit.
Yeah, well, exactly. And there are so many reasons why, if you find yourself hitting that red zone and you're too emotional, need to calm down. Like, you can't, and that's not a moment when that adrenaline is pumping. That's not, that is the hardest time to tell yourself to calm down. Right. And that comes down to different elements of training and experience. I don't know the experience of this officer. I also don't know his temperament. You know, I know some people just, people become police officers for different reasons, you know, and don't know the guy. So however, that is, there are plenty of times in which, you could blame the fact that he came in hot, but why was that dude laying hands on the officer, you know?
Because he was on parole and he didn't want to go back.
Totally. I get it.
So the story, maybe he wasn't on parole. I think the story was he was recently let out because he was wrongfully convicted. And that's the story that all the news channels were running. He, you know, wrongfully convicted man is shot by a cop. And but I know exactly who posted it. What the story should read is, you know, wrongfully, like, leave that part out and just say, you know, there was an interaction that went bad. And, yeah. You know, like, it was a bad scene. And when I share it with you, you'll see, like, it was bad all around.
Yeah. It's like watching donut operator videos, you know? So,
yep.
And it also goes back to, like, I think we were talking earlier about my brother being a police officer.
Yeah, I was saying I was much better cop than I was detective.
Yeah.
I was an active cop, lazy detective, and I'm not ashamed to say when I was in Special Victims, I was actually very motivated to do a good job for the children physically and sexually abused. And people say, "Oh, that sounds like a really hard job." And it was shitty at times. There were some really, really bad, sad cases. And I don't think anyone should spend an extended period of time there, which, you know, I did, I think, about the right amount of time, close to 3 years. But then once I started handling Home Depot larcenies and like larcenies of credit cards from stolen cars or stolen car, like I had zero motivation. It went down to zero. And I tell everyone I was a much better cop than the shell of the human that you see today.
Yeah. No, I can see how when the mission changes, things become much more difficult. And we were seeing that in the military when we pulled out of different conflicts and then our deployments turned into just sit around and wait kind of missions.
Peacekeeper.
So yeah. Hard. Well, not even that. You're just sitting around, you know? Yep. So you're waiting for, I mean, peace breaks out. What do when your job is to fight? And then people get in trouble because they're bored, you know, yep. But, and then they're looking for work and they're trying to create work, which is good and bad, you know?
And then you mentioned something about your brother. He's a cop now.
Not anymore. He just retired for the second time. He was a cop. He did 20 years. And then he did another, I don't know, 10 or so with another police force. After a while, he was like, okay, I've had enough, you know, I don't need to do this anymore. He was kind of over the bureaucracy. You know, they were demanding certain things of him. But I was telling you the story earlier, it's like one of the things that he used to do is he would go and try and find work, you know. And what's funny is I knew so much about my brother and the way the police worked that if I'm driving around at the end of the month and I get pulled over, I find myself getting angry. And I'm not angry because I got pulled over. I'm angry because I'm getting pulled over by that cop that didn't hit his quota for the month. And he waited until the 30th or whatever to finally start doing his job. And he pulls me over. I remember I just come back from Afghanistan and I got pulled over one time and I was.
I used to do a lot of community meetings and that question of quotas would come up a lot. And I would say, you know, most departments don't have an actual quota, like you have to write a ticket a day. But as a supervisor, if you have someone that works for you who is not in a particularly busy area, like say I was your supervisor, I was your direct sergeant. I would say, you know, Jim, you didn't see a single violation the entire month. You didn't see a single person on their cell phone the entire month. Like in an 8-hour shift, you can find one bad guy doing something that they shouldn't be doing. Yeah. And like you were saying, your brother was proactive. He would go out and he would find the bad guys doing something. And then you have the other spectrum where you have people who just wait for their 911 call and they may only get three 911 calls that they may only get an alarm and an aided case for service. You know, yeah. They may only get those two calls that entire day. So what did they do with the rest of those 7 hours that they were working?
Yeah. And that's. I think it's funny that I got my wife was like having a call calm me down as the guy was pulling up. I'd also only been home from Afghanistan for a short period of time, so I was still a little on edge, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, hang on, why are you rolling me up like for going seven over? You know, Anyway, so, but my brother, what he would do is he would use all those small, those minor infractions to identify people that had committed legitimate crimes.
Yeah.
And he was really big on, if they're cool with me, I'll give them a warning almost every time.
Yep.
But I remember one time, I was about to tell you the story, but we were driving around this neighborhood in Albuquerque and saw this vehicle's car registration expired. And the guy drove the other way for my brother, and we were driving this neighborhood, and the guy immediately made a turn right after we passed us. And my brother was like, I'll just let that go. And then he was like, maybe I won't. And then he turned around to go back the way where the guy had gone. And the guy was turning back around because he didn't want to go that way. He was doing that because he was trying to avoid my brother.
Yep.
So my brother pulls him over. And
Did he do a head on car stop?
He ended up finding a way to get behind the guy. He anticipated where the guy was going to go, so he got right behind him because of the way he was moving on the side streets. But he turned around, and my brother came the other way, and because he knew the streets so well, he's like, I'm just going to pop up right behind the guy over here. And so he pulls the guy over, and he had a mic on him, so I could hear everything he was saying in the vehicle. And he just looks in the window, and then he immediately goes, can you step out of the vehicle, please? And so by default, it's funny, even back then, I was kind of like, my brother's kind of a jerk. I was like, he didn't even do anything. He just looked at the guy for a second. Yeah. Well, I mean, he'd been doing it so long, he could read the guy's body language. The guy was shaking a little bit.
Yep.
You know, and there was no reason to be shaking on a general stop unless you got something, you know. And the guy goes, why do I got to get out? And he's like, just step out of the vehicle, please. So the guy finally steps out. Actually, and then so my brother puts him against the vehicle, pulls out his wallet. He has two IDs, same face, different names, you know. Yep. And he looks at the back of his car, and there's a whole bunch of new shoes. My brother's like, "Those are some nice kicks, man." And the guy's like, and then he checks his pocket, finds meth, you know. So he's like, "All right." So he handcuffs him, sits him in the vehicle right behind me. Turns out we went to middle school together. And then and he's like, "Dude, didn't you go to this school?" And I was like, yeah. He's like, I recognize you. And I was like, gosh dang it, dude. And you got rolled up in my brother's car. But so here's what ended up happening is the guy had been my brother takes the fake ID and he holds it up like this, and he just kind of bends it, and the plastic kind of pops off the front. My brother's like, here's where your friend went wrong when he made your fake ID. And he's like, coloring's wrong here. He's like, I can just tell by the way it feels that this is off. That's why I was able to like immediately identify that. And then he's like, so why do you have a fake ID? And he gives the stupidest answer you've ever heard in your life, where he's like, oh, my buddy was just wanted to try something out. And I was like, oh, yeah, I just want to try something out. He's like, how come I have – and then he's like, what am I going to find when I look in the back of your car? Because right now it looks like you got a lot of shoes for some reason. And he's like, well – he's like, do I consent to check your vehicle? And the guy's like, yes, because he knows he's going to get in there anyway.
Right.
You know? So he goes and looks in there, whole bunch of blank checks. So my brother's like, what are these checks? What's this for? And then he runs his name at the same time. That dude's on probation. And he's like, look, man, you've already committed 4 felonies here that I can name off the top of my head. You're either going to give us something for every one of those particular felonies, or you're going back to jail. And the guy was like, there's a meth house right there. There's a meth house right there. He's like, these guys are doing what? He's like, these guys are going to the casino with these blank checks, with these fake IDs, and cashing out $7,000 to $10,000 a day. I can show you where their house is. And so by the end of the night, we were sending that guy into that house to go get more of those blank checks to get more evidence on these people committing white collar crimes. It was crazy. And that's how
you get promoted.
He ended up confiscating the guy's car. He did all kinds of stuff off of the fact that he just was like, I'm going to check this guy's registration. And that's how we used to do business all the time. But what was messed up about my brother's police force, this is funny now because people are screaming about cameras and stuff like that. Everybody has to have one. Back then, the police force didn't have enough money to give cops all cameras. My brother's like, I want one because people make claims against me and I can't defend myself. It's my word against theirs. But he had to get cars confiscated to raise the right amount of money so that he could buy equipment like cameras so that he could defend himself. It was crazy.
That's funny. That's pretty funny. Yeah. What is it going to mean when we actually have, like, when we go from 5G to 6G and then 7G? Like, what does that actually mean? I actually don't know, and I'm curious about that.
Oh, okay. Too. So every 10 years, a new telecommunications protocol comes out. We just happen to be talking about 4G because 4G, but there was 3G and 2G and 1G. All those things existed. We just didn't call them that back then. You just called it a cell phone. That 1G was like Zach Morris phone on Saved by the Bell. You know, that was 1G. 2G came out in 1990. It didn't start becoming really common until the 2000s when everybody had those little black clam phones, you know. Then 3G came out that same time. But each time they did that, what they were doing is I won't get overly specific, but they were just chopping up the radio waves in different ways so they could add more channels so more people could use that same radio waves. But 4G, they were using a type of technology called OFDMA, orthogonal frequency division multiple access. It's a real fancy way of saying they basically filled the spectrum with all the possible channels, and they only had about 25 megahertz to work with. And they were like, well, we've basically maxed out the capacity for these radio waves. If you have, think about radio waves like a highway, right? You got a 4-lane highway, but the lanes are all full of cars.
Yep.
And you're like, well, how do I increase the bandwidth on that? And they're like, well, we don't know of any other new protocols because they don't. OFDMA basically is one of the most advanced protocols. They can do a little bit of tweaking, but in general, not doing anything new with it. But they're like, well, what if we increase the frequency? We got more bandwidth. So 5G, they went from operating in like 2.1 gigs, 2.0 or whatever, to suddenly operating at 28 or 38 gigahertz.
That's a big difference. Yeah.
Yeah. But your range of operation is dramatically shorter because the frequency, the wavelength is smaller.
Yep.
And so wavelengths, if they're really short like that, it requires a lot of energy for them to travel a greater distance. That's why like HF, high frequency radio waves that are, the wavelengths are super long. They can travel. You can literally bounce those off the moon, right? And then you could, and with the one big long antenna you could be communicating, but your bandwidth is garbage. You have hardly, it's like a kilobit of data you could be pushing across that. You know, that's like a Voyager flying off in space. That's like the kind of bandwidth you're getting off of that thing, right? So 6G is going to be an extension of what they're doing with 5G in those higher frequencies, but they're going to start moving into other mediums that you're not expecting, like they're going to start using light as a means of communicating.
That's cool.
So the LED in your houses could be like your Wi-Fi. They call it Li-Fi.
Yeah.
And so they could be doing that. So anywhere light is emitted, you could literally be seeing what offers you comms. So if it's blocked off, then you're like, why is my reception bad? It's like, well, can you see the light? You're like, no, that's why. Because the light can't get to your system, so therefore you'd have no connection, right? So that's the limitation of light. But anyway, those are examples of different ways in which it's going to proliferate with 6G. And then there's other digital stuff I could get into, but that's the gist.
So this is the way my mind works when you talk about like future stuff. I was thinking about this company I invested in, Nano Dimensions. They do 3D printing, and I still think it's going to take off, but it took such a bomb over the course of the last, I think I've had it for like 4 years. Yeah. I put like maybe $1,000 into it, but I still think that 3D printing is going to take off because I've seen a lot of 3D printed guns. So I think 3D printing is going to take off for every aspect of what's a technology that you're, and for everyone listening, this is not investment advice, but what's a technology that you are excited about that if you had a few extra $1,000, like you might think about putting your money into it?
The one that I always bring up, is, augmented reality contact lenses. So there's a company called Mojo Vision. And good friends with a lot of the people that work there. They're great people. But what they do is you look them up on their website. They've been on eye, and I've physically held the contact lens, and I can attest that this is real. But what's cool about it is they have a femto projector, a projector that literally sits 1 millimeter away from the cornea of your eye on a scleral contact lens that goes on your eye.
That's crazy.
It has has batteries inside of it, so it operates off of Wi-Fi. It has its own energy, and you're able to, right now it's monochromatic, but eventually it'll be color, and you'll be able to, like you and I could be talking, and if I get a text message, I could get a small little dot that appears in the corner of my eye, and I could look up to the side, doing optical tracking, and then pull up a menu, and then be able to select with my eye by dwelling on the words. And then when I'm done with it, I just go back to looking straight and it disappears.
That goes back to wearing it externally versus actually getting an implant.
Yeah. With that, you wouldn't need to do it. Here's the reason why I'm excited about that. As you look at things like Apple's, I mean, what they're the vision and all that kind of stuff that everybody's trying to create. Everybody's really excited about augmented reality.
Have you heard about human or humane? I think
human AI.
Yeah.
That's garbage.
It's so garbage.
yeah. So the laser projected thing, that keeps coming up every few years where it comes back. So I did a whole bunch of human machine teaming work.
Where it's in your hand, basically.
Yeah, that's terrible form of display.
Okay.
Like it's there's a website. If you want to, there's a guy named Carl Gutog. Is KGUT. Hang on. His website is KGUTTAG.com, KGUTOG.com. And his website's Carl Gutog on Tech. He was the youngest fellow in Texas Instruments history. And all he does is tear apart augmented reality systems. He'll go in there, he pulls up the patent, he gets a hold of the gear, he literally rips apart the hardware, he explains how the technology works, and then he goes, this is why it is or is not a valid idea. And his most recent post on Humane AI just ripped them apart. He was like, okay, this is a new riff on an old scam.
Okay.
And it's like, it looks cool, but what you're actually getting from it is a modern, he's like, they keep saying AI, but he's like, I don't know where the AI is. It's definitely not in the laser projection. That's why I'm a proponent of the contact lens, is because it gets rid of all of the problems you have with all of these other systems, because with those other systems, distance is the problem.
Yes.
The farther you get away from your eye, the harder it is to get enough, referred to as nits, but lumens per meter square, the appropriate amount of light to enter your eye for you to see it. So unless you're in a poorly lit room, like you're in a dark room in your bedroom, your dark bedroom at night, you can't see it very well. In the daytime, it gets washed out.
I would much rather a glasses than a contact lens, though.
I get it. I understand why.
I don't like touching my eyes.
That's personal preference. From a technology standpoint, it still operates like a regular contact lens. It still increases your vision. But here's what it also can do. It can also give you things like actually, I don't know if I can say that. I'll tell you offline. You basically have – it can enhance certain features of your natural capability.
That's
that you
amazing.
Wouldn't have otherwise.
And that's so freaking amazing.
And so it – but because it's only a millimeter away and it's projecting directly into your eye, it you can see it significantly better than if it were on glasses, because they have to use what's called a diffracted waveguide. And so you'll have like sometimes – like the HoloLens, for example, you have all these little striations on the lens. And when the light hits it, it diffracts and then points back into your eye. Like it condenses all the light, and that's what allows you to see images, right? But – you have to put a whole bunch of energy into that in order for you to see it anywhere other than in a dark room, right? So you go outside at night, in the daytime, it washes out. It doesn't even exist anymore. The other thing that sucks about it is it can only present in one part of your frame of reference. And because it's so clunky, when they showed it to us, they're trying to enter. There was this big army program called IVAS. And when I first saw what they were doing, I was like, that's a terrible idea. But you guys go ahead and spend your several billion dollars on that and discover that it's a bad idea. And the first time I put it on, everybody's getting sick, because if you don't get the frequency rate right on the distortion and how when it moves, it gives you motion sickness because it. And so they had to. OK, so they tweaked that. They're like, OK, we got it. We're good. But what people don't keep in mind is when you're in combat or you're in a high stress scenario, you go from processing things cognitively with your new brain to going to processing it with your old brain. You go back to your lizard brain and you want complete access to all your senses. And now you've got this thing that inhibits your ability to see with your natural vision.
You're
relying, it's not just tunnel vision. You're literally got this stuff on your head that is limiting you from seeing things, right?
Yeah.
But then you add tunnel vision on top of that, and now you have confusers. And so your natural response is, I'm going to throw up that thing right off my head, right? And so, or if you're like, I'm going to continue to use this, and let's say it fogs up, let's say it doesn't operate effectively. Now you just have something that's blocking your vision for no reason. Whereas with a contact lens, if I'm looking straight, I don't see anything anyway. It's just contact lenses. But if I intentionally pull up the information I need, or if I have it set to where it'll allow me to see certain things on the edge of my peripheral, like a gaming interface, I can. And then it also, well, here's what's even cooler about contact lenses.
So how do you interact? I'm curious, how do you interact with it? So like it's in your field of vision, but like a gaming interface, but how do you actually choose the thing that you want?
Have you used the Quest?
Not yet.
Or a VR system?
No.
So when you put those on, they track your position of your eye. And when you move your eye without moving your head, it registers the fact that you've moved your eye into the corner.
Okay.
And if you dwell, it'll pull up menus for you.
Okay.
And so you can interact literally like a mouse, but it's your eye.
Yeah.
Right? And so let's say I want to communicate with you and I have a series of predetermined messages that I want to send. I just let you know, okay, I'm at phase one. Phase one. Message to send everybody. Right? I don't even have to talk.
Freaking cool.
I can communicate directly with you. And so that's why that technology excites me, is because my whole goal when I was working on the innovation directorate was, how do I get back to being slick? How do I get rid of junk on my body? Because if you go back to the Greek hoplite and the Spartans, outside of certain particular specialties, the average soldier carried 30 pounds of weight, right? That was true all the way through World War One.
You made me think of another type of technology that would be pretty freaking amazing. And you don't have to confirm or deny if we have it now, but like something like my middle son talked about how cool our skin is, where as soon as you get cut, it starts to close up. Now imagine if you had clothing like Kevlar that actually did that.
That's what graphene does. Well, actually, no, graphene doesn't self-heal. Graphene is literally like, it's okay. Now I take that back. Graphene operates completely differently. Graphene is like, it can literally only be like three atoms thick, but they're bonded so tightly that you can't penetrate it. And so you can have extremely lightweight, efficient armor that you can't penetrate it. You would get, you'd break bones because it would still have impact.
Right.
But the self-healing part, that's like nanobot type stuff, you know?
Yeah.
But,
yeah, yeah.
We're kind of far away from that. That's still out there.
What's the difference between, autonomous machines and automation?
So automation, think about like stacking steps. So you're like, automation is an easier way to describe automation is, actually, here's the analogy I always give people. So a drone that you buy straight out of the box is automated. If you say, hey, I want you to fly these three GPS points without me interfering with it, and I say go, the drone will take off, fly those three GPS points and come back, and everybody goes, look, it's autonomous. I'm like, no, it's not. You know how it's not autonomous? Because it wasn't making any decisions for itself. It was traveling from point A to point B, and if there was any obstruction, it would hit them, right? It knew generally where it was. And you could make this argument, I'm being a little pedantic, but the when we describe this, people ask me, is this an autonomous system? And I'll say, well, it's automated because it's making rudimentary decisions. I told it where point B was, and it traveled from point A to point B, and its sensors let it know where it was relative in its own space. However, it was blind. It has no idea what's happening outside of it, right? That Skydio drone I was telling you about, imagine if you tell it to travel to point A to point B, but it knows where it's creating a map of the world around it at all times, and it can dynamically respond to any obstruction. So now if I say fly to point A to point B, but I want you to travel at 30 feet of altitude, and then as it's traveling at 30 feet, a tree gets in the way. What's cool about that drone is it goes, oh, there's a tree. It searches for a way to get around the tree, and then it goes around the tree and goes back to its original mission.
That's cool.
That's basically what driverless cars do, is they go from point A to point B. They are measuring and estimating the environment around them, and they're identifying the best path to get there. But that's not the top of this little pyramid that I'm describing. The top of the pyramid is, hey, I need you to go clear that building. I didn't tell it where in the building to go. I just said, there's a building. I want you to check all the rooms. I didn't say this room first, then this room, which is what I'd have to do with those other systems. I just said, go to the door. So its computer vision detects a door, classifies it as a door, recognizes the door, recognizes it's empty because the sensors can see beyond the door's entryway. And then as it goes in the room, we had to teach it the proper tactics for clearing a building. So it doesn't just chase target of opportunity. Let's just go, oh, there's a hallway. I'm going to go straight down the hallway. No. Right. If there's a door to the right, cut right. Door to the left, cut left. Clear that room first before you go deeper.
And look at every corner. Right.
Yeah, so it'll go in and what it'll do is, it by the time it got good at it, it would do this asymptotic movement, which is like instead of like a right angle, it would curve into the room because it knew what it could sense where the edges were. Would curve into the room. It would hit the area. It would spin in a circle because it saw everything and then come right back out the door. It was just that fast. Wow. But it was making the decision. So instead of traveling from point A to point B, it was traveling from point A to B1, B2, B3, B4, depending upon what it decided. That's autonomy. Because it made the decisions on its own. The other one was automation because you were just stacking basic decisions.
How far are we from in the very beginning? We talked about robot soldiers, which is cool and also scary. Yeah. But how far are we from that?
So it goes back to that paradox I told you about, right? That it is so much harder to get the processing capacity and the sensing to be able to interact in that space reliably. I worked with that like robot dog companies for a long time, and we worked on the quadrupedal movement. I was excited about them, but I was always like, I won't present these to any of my warfighters until I can kick this thing down a ditch and it can make its own decisions more efficiently how to get out of there. And the warfighter never has to think about what it's doing. It just does. It just moves. Hmm. Right. Until then, use this thing to patrol bases where you have control of the environment completely. And it's just a camera letting everybody know what's going on. It's a big Roomba. When you get to the point later on down the road, it'll eventually get there. But the concern that people should not be worried about is I'm way more concerned about things like ChatGPT than I am about robots. Way more.
Because of misinformation or
that's
another
a big
reason.
One. That's a big
or another,
one.
Another
because
reason.
It creates garbage. So it not just because it creates garbage, because and I've said this in other podcasts, AI is a reflection of us as a society because it builds models off of what we feed it.
Yep.
So if it's feeding back to us these weird, almost stereotypical images of things, or it gives us information that we feel is right or left leaning or whatever we want to call it, it's because that's what we fed it. Right. And so, but there's so much petabytes of data, so many petabytes of data that it's drawing from to create these models. They don't know what's inside of the neural network, the little black boxes in there. They don't know how it's prioritizing what it uses to create the model, that it outputs stuff that doesn't make sense, that is both extremely impressive, but concerning at the same time. I am mainly concerned with the ability for those systems to just put out information that is not correct or to reinforce people's worldviews in a way that it becomes an accelerating, it operates like a catalyst for bad behavior.
I once heard a quote, I'm going to butcher it, but it said, if the product is free, then you're the product. And you talk about how data is more valuable than oil. Can you expand on that?
So in order for any AI to grow, it needs data. In order to create a model, it needs data. And so your private data, so a lot of times people think of marketing as like demographics. It's not demographics these days. It's psychographics. It's you as a person. It's not your skin color or religion or race or whatever. It's none of that. That is one small piece of a larger whole. And if they're trying to find you as a person, they need the psychographic information. And that is all comes in the form of all the data that you have available to you available online. And that's where AI scraping, not crawling, there's a difference. Scraping is what people do on what AI does illegally, where it's just pulling everything it can grab. Crawling is what like Google search engines do, where they're pulling legal information that is saved in cookies, right? Scraping is when it's pulling all of your data off of Facebook, all your contacts, and then it's buying your credit card information off of the dark web and creating a massive repository of everything associated with you that can then go back and be like, okay, I know that this person has this many children. He's interested in this particular type of adult content. You know, I can create a honeypot for this person anytime I want, and this is how I would lure them in. And then AI can really build all that out for you based off of that psychographic information.
If I see an ad for something involving AI or making money, I'm like all about it. Yeah. If I see a video that's showing me something with like jiu-jitsu, judo, wrestling, like it grabs my attention. And it's so crazy how the algorithms work and they know what I'm into.
Yeah. I think that is, it's both an amazing thing and it's also the downfall of our society, because people are excited about AI giving you a tailored experience, but what it tends to tailor to. There are good things like the ones you mentioned, like it's like, because I was a martial artist myself, you know, and there's certain things I'm like, yeah, I love watching that. That's not my entire personality though.
Right.
You know? And so the things that concern me is if you have just the slightest inclination towards extremist ideas, it's going to just keep feeding that to you because it creates an emotional response. And then you dwell on it. I mean, social media is really bad in that respect because it's designed for reinforcing dopamine. And I would argue that it's designed to reinforce vices, not the good parts of your thought, you know, like, and because of that, that's the thing that concerns me the most. And and people ask me, well, when do you think that change took place? And I was like, when Facebook went away from being a place where you had a niche group of friends where you could be with, and it was like a cool club that you couldn't be with. Nobody else was allowed in. When it went from that to just dumping information on you, that was when it all ended. Is when they can feed you what to think.
I actually don't enjoy Facebook. I use it to connect with people. I just don't enjoy the platform anymore. I do like Instagram. I do like some of their other products, like Messenger, obviously. Snapchat, it's just like a few close family friends. Do you spend any time on any of the platforms? Like, are you on LinkedIn? If people want to connect with you.
Yeah, I have LinkedIn and I have all the social media except TikTok. I won't touch TikTok, but
okay.
that's a bit off brand for me because, you know, it's literally feeding Chinese data. So, I mean, it literally is just a Chinese collection and propaganda machine is all it is. People don't realize that it is 100%. So, but I have them because it's a necessary evil, but when I was in the military, I didn't have any. I shut them all off. I canceled all of them. Because I didn't want any social media presence to protect my family. However, ironically, that also draws attention. It's like, why does this person have zero presence online?
Yes.
Right? That's freaking strange.
So when I was in uniform, my name on Facebook was David Diem, like Carpe Diem.
Yeah.
Now that I'm not interacting with the public as much and I'm not out there like publicly, now, like, I don't mind putting my real name out there as much.
Yeah. No, I had, and even now, like, I mean, JL Hancock's my pen name. So,
yeah.
But my social media is associated with that, except for LinkedIn, but that is my real name. But, and I don't really care if people actually figure out what my real name is. It doesn't matter at this point. Oh, I created it when I was still active duty, so I needed to.
How much of, like, security, internet security do you do, and how, like, frequently do you do it? You know, like taking your name. I've never done this, but I know there's companies that they for law enforcement, military and other types of government employees, they'll remove your personal data from the internet as best they can.
Yeah. Like doing things like freezing Social Security. Don't lock it. The ones if you they'll offer you to have it locked and that doesn't actually help. Freezing it is the way to go. You know, for me, mainly it's just a lot of my search engine optimization is focused around my online persona, but my real name is very generic. Yes. So that's
you're lucky. You're lucky. You're lucky there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have 13. It's either 13 David Leitz in the US or I think there were 3 in New York. So and the funny thing on Facebook, I connected with everyone with the same exact name as me.
Oh, really?
I was like, hey, you have the same name as me. Let's connect. And I just connected with every single one. There's not that, but my name is not that common. So it's, you know, I don't really have anything to worry about at this point. I did run into a guy that I locked up like 15 years ago in the gym. He's like, hey, you locked me up like 15 years ago. And I was like, well, was I a jerk to you? Or was I a good guy? He's like, oh no, you were a good guy. And then he said he's changed his life around and he ends up getting locked up for like some federal drug sales like a week later after I had that conversation with him. Bummer. And one of my coworkers said, why would he even like talk to you? I think just because he was curious, was his memory right? And I think he was just like curious, you know. It's pretty funny. Have you ever been recognized by anyone that you used to work with? You're kind of a ghost.
Well, I mean, what do you mean by I used to work with? Like my colleagues? Yes.
Yeah. 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 Well, people that you didn't work with directly.
No. And if I did, there's something seriously wrong. Because if I was ever in your house in a professional capacity, I don't know. I'm just thinking about all the situations where I would have been in someone's house. If I ever ran into any of those people, it would have been a very awkward interaction. Especially if they even remembered me, because that would be even more strange. Because I'd be like, I would.
100 missions. That's a lot of missions that you ran.
But it's like, over 100. But at the same time, it's like I wasn't
overseas.
Yeah, those are all overseas. Those were in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Philippines, and they ranged from doing like direct action raids where you were just, you know, going in and then there were some that were more covert. More clandestine. I can't say covert, but more clandestine in nature. Like they were just like, you know, hiding somewhere, running gear. Those I enjoyed actually the most. It was like being in a hotel somewhere. You needed to grab a certain type of intelligence and you had only a certain moment to get it. Everything was set up so you could grab it. Those I found actually more fun than kicking down the doors.
That's pretty cool.
But kicking down the doors gets a little old after a while. People are like, what do you mean? You don't want things. It's like you want things to pop off and then you don't at the same time. You know, it's this mix. And then when they don't, you're like, well, that sucked. I kind of wish things popped off. And then something pops off and somebody gets hurt. And you're like, well, that sucks. My buddy got hurt. I don't want that to happen. But the other one was just like, did I or did I not grab this thing? And no one has any idea I did it. That was when it was cool. You know,
there's another guy. I don't know if it's his real name or not. Gavin Stone. It sounds like a made up name. I want to link you guys up. I interviewed him just last week, and he has a British accent, but he's worked with the U.S. also in various spy operations. That's his term, not mine. So I keep using the word spy. We just had a really cool conversation about doing things like that, like getting information. He talked about eliciting information from people and having conversations where they don't even realize that you're eliciting the information.
Yeah. So he was doing a lot of human intelligence?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's basically like being a detective, man. You're just
working
people for information without them knowing it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, usually when I walk into a room, they know the reason why I want to talk to them. they have an idea.
Yeah. At the same time though, it's like how to get them to talk, you know, building a rapport, same tactics.
That's everything. You know? That's everything. But it's also the same skill that helps me with podcasting, because a lot of times I'll jump on with people and I won't even research. I'll do a little bit of research, but I won't even research them. Usually I'll know that, you know, they were former law enforcement or former military. I talked to a fireman yesterday who's a pretty cool chief of fire department. That's pretty much all I need to know. Did you serve the country in some form or capacity? And all right, cool, we could be friends and we can talk.
yeah.
I really appreciate you hopping on. I don't want this to go too long, so I'm just going to ask you my five final questions. And then I literally could talk tech like all day. And it's not even that I'm like not that knowledgeable about it. It just excites me. And I could talk about martial arts all day long too. Like we'll get into that conversation next time or another time. If you ever don the headphones again. Last five, what's your definition of a hero?
I honestly, it's pretty simple. It's somebody that puts others above themselves.
And you've been in some pretty stressful situations. What techniques did you use to calm yourself?
You know, a lot of what came down to was repetition and training. If you have prepared yourself, it is easier to adapt in a scenario of high stress. And surprisingly, just really taking a moment to take a breath and to scan your surroundings, understand your situational awareness before you act and not get overly fixated on the action it has helped me a lot. One quick story. When I was getting, I got married, my wife and I got married 3 months before my first deployment. We had known each other super long, but we just felt like it was right. So we got married and I went up and we were picking up her stuff. She was living in Salt Lake City at the time and I was living in San Diego. I went up to go pick her up in my truck and we were driving back on the highway and I hit a bunch of ice going 70 in my Tacoma. I had received a lot of training and off-road driving and things like that at that point in time. But when my truck started fishtailing really hard on the ice, right? But it was interesting because my training just kicked in. And so I just calmly started turning into the swerve, you know, and just riding it out, foot off the gas, just let it like ease off its speed. my wife's cat was laying on my lap. So the cat just starts going, row, row, row. Cat was freaking out, right? And then my wife, she was hitting me going, babe, babe, babe. Like, but the whole time, I'm just like, I wasn't saying anything because I was like, look, there's only one thing I can control right now. I can control this wheel and I can control how I react to it. And things could go one way or the other. But as long as I stay calm and I keep breathing and I focus on the task at hand, it'll work itself out. And so literally that's like the main thing is, and I can think of another experience. It's driving out on the 8 here in San Diego when this guy's truck flipped right before we got there and his kid got thrown out of the vehicle and he got like smashed up and I ended up on the side of the road holding this guy's head together because it had split open for like 45 minutes. And it was funny because all the training that we received, it just kicked right in. And same thing happened in combat where you're like, I can only control so much, but the thing I can control, I'm going to focus on that one thing and I'm going to find calm in the fact that I can control this. Right. It's when you can't control anything and you can't control yourself that you go back. What Dave Grossman and On Combat refers to, you know, and he goes past the red into the black and you're no longer in control anymore. That's when you get your serious problems. So it's recognizing when you're getting there. I mean, like, okay, I got to take a minute. I got to find a way to calm down or I've got to get out of here. One of the two, I better move. I got to make an action. And that was really, the biggest benefit of all the training that I received was that repetition makes things easier.
You have so much technical knowledge, so much experience. Would you ever consider coaching people like one-to-one or one-to-many, or do you prefer consulting?
I actually mentor at UCSD. I mentor startups that are trying to get in the tech space, and I help with these this thing called I4NS, Innovation for National Security. So I help students that are working to try and help national security problems. And I help walk them through the thinking and things like that. So I do that. And I'm always open to more. So
yeah, that's cool. That's cool. That's actually really cool. What's your greatest strength? What's your power today?
I think the thing that makes it sounds weird. I don't like talking to myself like that, but if I were to say anything, it's not so much that I know a lot. It's that I know how to apply the things I know. And so I can find ways in which I've gleaned certain types of information and I can make it relevant to a situation to give me a better perspective. And that analytical thinking has always been my strength.
You a chess player? This is kind of like off the,
what's funny is I'm not,
you're not, not.
Like I can, it's funny. Cause like that kind of strategy, but if you get me in a room with a person and I'm trying to figure out what makes that person tick, I can figure it out right away. Yeah. And then I'll try to find a way to, and it's not manipulation. It's just like, all right, I know what your motivation is, whether intrinsic or extrinsic.
So if you're not a chess player, that means you probably don't play Texas Hold'em also, right? You probably don't play cards.
I don't play cards, no.
Yeah, and when I find a chess player, I usually find a poker player too. Or if I find a poker player, they usually know how to play chess.
What's funny is I have friends that are incredible chess players and incredible poker players, and I could read them like a book. Like inside and out, I know exactly what they're going to do all the time in their real life, but not when they're playing the game. If we're playing chess, great. Where it's like it's in a two-dimensional space, and it's whether or not you have a card, and they're doing the math associated with it, I'm like, I can't, you know, that's great, that's your skill, man.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I can tell whether or not you're going to do something stupid because I'll watch it in your eyes.
My last question for you, Jim: if you had a comic book superpower, what would it be and why? I know you've probably thought about this before.
I think this goes back to the career choice that I went to. Like, you always want to default to like saying, do I have physical power? For me, it would always be the mental powers, you know, because that person could manipulate a situation to control, like Charles Xavier, right? Like,
in X-Men. Yes, that's who I want to model after. Like, I want all of the mental powers also. That, yeah. I always, when people ask me the question, that's my answer too. But I want all of them. I want telekinesis. I want the ability to reach into people's mind. I want pyrokinesis. I want all of the mental abilities.
Yeah. Wires with your brain.
So, yeah, why not? Yeah, why not?
Right. Yeah. No, I, it's like, as I've gotten older and when I was younger, it was like, I was kind of a weak little kid. And, you know, I was always worried about getting jumped. That's when my parents put me in martial arts, my grandparents rather.
What style? Was it karate?
So I started in Taekwondo. My brother got jumped and this is not the cop. I have two brothers.
Okay.
He got jumped at a park when he was a freshman, got his jaw broken, spent the entire summer with his jaw wired shut.
Oh my God.
And so my grandparents, I was like 9 at the time, and it was the '80s in New Mexico, and just a lot of gangs, man, just a lot of stuff going on. And we were still latchkey kids. So there was the potential of getting jumped all the time, like everywhere we went. And so, started in Taekwondo, at that time, this is pre UFC. I ended up after a couple of years switching to a school where it was with a guy by the name of, the entire school is run by a guy named Ray Barrera. The system was called Swan Da, but it was an eclectic system. He had an 8th degree black belt in 3 martial arts. He was an International Martial Arts Hall of Fame. He was a Green Beret in Vietnam. Like, he was incredible martial artist. But he was combining martial arts before it became a thing. And at his detriment, because people were like, you can't do this, right? And then he taught us a little bit of jiu-jitsu, but it was mainly stand-up fighting. It was mainly like, how do you deal with multiple opponents? And he was like, the first thing you don't do is tackle one and take them on the ground, because then their buddies are going to come and start stomping, right?
Right.
He's like, you get out of there, right? It's good to know this
your
stuff.
Feet,
but
your feet are your number one defense. Jocko Willink said it, and I couldn't agree more. Your feet. Start running.
Yeah. It's funny that Jocko says that. Jocko was in charge of the office. He was the officer in charge of the training detachment when I did my first workup. So he was the guy who was giving us our feedback after we did our training runs and stuff. So it's funny seeing him as a podcaster and all that, because I knew him back then. I didn't know him. He wouldn't remember me because I was just another face, you know. But
right.
Anyway, that's totally what it was. So New Mexico in martial arts was all about me just learning how to keep myself alive. And then as I got older and I recognized that I could actually fight and hold my own, but at the same time, there's always someone going to be stronger than you.
Yes.
But you can usually find a good way to outsmart most people. So
yeah, always have a plan. I watch when people have a little bit of a limp. I'm like, yep, I'm kicking them in that knee.
Yeah. It's funny. The first thing that goes when you stop training is your timing.
Yes.
So that was always my skills. I had good timing, but since I haven't trained as much, I'm like, wow, that goes away really quickly.
Yeah. Now I think I would be more inclined to just talk my way out of any situation or take off running if I had to, because I'm not a tough guy. I tell my girl all the time, I'm a lover, I'm not a fighter. I know how to fight, but I'm not a fighter. My youngest son wants to be a MMA fighter, and it's my fault because I put him in wrestling from kindergarten all the way up. And I was a huge UFC fan from 1993 all the way to today. And, you know, he's grown up watching it. So now that's his dream. And I don't want him to do that. But it's like, I need to be there to support him, you know?
Yeah. No, it's cool. He'll figure it out.
Yeah, I hope he does. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
No, I was going to say, just like, watch your head, man. Just be careful.
Yeah. Head injuries.
Yeah. Just, I know. That's kind of kept me from going back into certain things. It's just because I'm like, my brain's the only thing that's going to keep going. My body's going to keep falling apart. I can keep pushing as hard to keep it in shape, but as long as my brain's intact, I'm a happy camper.
I love all martial arts. I love every style, every type of technique. Boxing, I love the slipping and the ducking, but I don't like getting hit. So I don't want to do that, because I don't like that feeling of the headache afterwards.
Yeah.
So
my grandfather was a really good boxer. He used to make brooms when he was a kid, And a lot of people don't know that they didn't have machines. They would twine them by hand, and he got really fast with twining, and it made him an incredibly quick boxer. So it was interesting listening to his style, because he would show me some stuff, and then when I started learning my martial arts, and it was like, he's like, why are you using your feet? But anyway, it was a nice blending of things, and I had a really good eclectic background until all of a sudden everybody's doing mixed martial arts and kicking people in the calves and crap, and you're like, whoa, this is a different direction.
Jim, thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to reading your book. I'll say the title of it one more time: Hawk Enigma by J.L. Hancock. I am ordering that as soon as we get off of here, and then I'll send you a picture of it just to let you know that I actually got it.
Right on, man. It's cool.
All right, family. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Everyone I interview, I've chosen for you guys because of their story. And I hope that you get some value every single time. If you did get value or just simply enjoyed the episode, please share the episode with someone that you know. If you know of a guest, a frontline hero that has an amazing story, something uplifting or a positive message, hit me up in the contact form of www.davidleith.com or DM me at Instagram at @davidleith1. Subscribe to the show, because I have some really phenomenal guests coming up in the next few weeks that you definitely don't want to miss. All right, one.